This is the Active Pause Podcast with Serge Prengel. Today, I am talking with Peter Levine, developer of Somatic Experiencing, as he reflects on his life and work. So, hi, Peter.
Hi, Serge.
It's great to see you again. And I really was very touched and moved by reading your latest book, in which you reveal so much about your journey.
Yeah.
I was both moved by it, but also struck by the role of active imagination.
Aha, yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, first of all, I wasn't planning to write this as a book originally. It was only for my own personal excavation. I'm at the age where I clearly, even if I'm healthy and vibrant, I have less years in front of me than I have from behind me. And so this was a way kind of to excavate my own life, to look at the important things that have happened to me, that have impacted me, both that were positive and supportive and those which were threatening and dangerous and violent. So a friend of mine, very close friend, said, again, this was just like a journal, me penning a journal. And she said, you should really write it as a book. And I said, no way, it's too personal, it's too vulnerable. And I don't know how people would see me. And she said, well, why don't you think about it? So I thought about it. Oh, speaking of active imagination, one aspect of active imagination is that sometimes an important dream will come to me that will really help me find a specific solution to what I'm wrestling with. So again, not having the idea of publishing it as a book, but as my own personal writing to myself. And in the dream, I'm standing in front of a large field. And I have in my hands a manuscript, in both hands. And so I'm looking to the left, to the right, to the left. And I just cannot decide what to do. And I feel conflicted and stuck. So in that moment of not knowing where to go, a wind comes from behind me and takes all of these pages and brings them out into filling the whole meadow. So I realized that I was going to put this and let it land where it may. And some people, I think, will be touched and helped and also supportive of their own healing. And I think other people will, I don't know, use me as a target against their own issues. So, but again, it was clear that I was going to let them land where they may. And they did.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm relieved that happened, even though it was not my conscious choice, but it was an unconscious choice.
Yeah.
My conscious was making the choice for me, I guess you could say. But you're talking about active imagination.
Actually, I want to maybe just stay there a little bit in that story, because I find that story, as you're mentioning it, also very illustrative of you living in process.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, 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 process, right? Yeah, I think that's one of the gifts and the curses that I've had, that I am a work in progress.
Mm-hmm.
And I honor that. I mean, you know, I'm not at the answer. I'm not at the solutionation. I am following my heart, mm-hmm, and telling my truth. And that was the commitment I made to myself, that I would follow my truth wherever it would lead me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it took me to some interesting places. And so getting back to the whole idea of active imagination, you know, while I was beginning to develop somatic experience in the late 60s and into the 70s, I was also working on my doctoral dissertation in medical biophysics at Berkeley. And I was also teaching a class at the natural science nat at the biology department. And at the end of the day, I would often go to my favorite restaurant, which was on San Pablo Avenue, the Beggar's Banquet. And the waitresses there were just wonderful and kind and warm to me. And they would sit me in my usual table with two chairs. And then they would almost always start by bringing a bowl of really warm vegetable soup. Yum. And that, along with that, some French bread that's crispy on the outside and warm and moist on the inside. And I was transported, like so many of the questions from the day just kind of came and went. But one day, when I was starting to drink my soup, eat my soup, off to the left, the image of a man came into my view. And he had this really wild, unkempt hair, and he was wearing a rumpled jacket that was two or three sizes too large for him. And he kind of motioned in this image to the chair as though he wanted to visit with me. So I, with my body, I just invited him in. And when he sat down, I realized this was an image of Albert Einstein. And I, of course, am a scientist also. And, you know, I realized that I wasn't actually seeing this man who I recognize as Albert Einstein, but that this was a process sometimes which is called active imagination. And when I did a little research about that, it said, it's, by the way, it's not anything like hypnosis or mental imagery. It's really the uniting of conscious and unconscious processes and holding them together. And active imagination is what it's called. And when I did some reading or research on it, it was written that that this is a talent that children have, a gift, I would say, that children have, but that adults don't have at all. And I remember thinking that's actually adults need it more than anyone else, you know. And again, as I say, in my to my understanding, this was not a real encounter with a real person, but some kind of a imaginative process that was coming from my unconscious, preconscious, unconscious experience. And after I recognized it was Einstein, I started to carry on an imaginary, quote, conversation with the professor. And I asked him some questions about what I was studying and what I was learning and where I was needing to go forward. And to my questions, he would answer questions about my questions. This is the way Socrates taught his students, the Socratic dialogue. And this went on for a period of close to a year. And one of the last encounters we had when I was working with people, and this was like in 19, early 70s, I was surprised that so many things that happened to people, traumas, but also positive experiences, don't come from their life, but come from their parents and their parents' parents and their grandparents and their great-grandparents and all of their ancestral line. So I told him about my interest there, and he was very taken because I think he had, you know, of course, embodied some of the Jewish experience. And so, in it's sort of like a dream within a dream, or a dream within the act of imagination, he takes me to a pond, and he has a yardstick, and all along the yardstick are a number of small stones. So he holds it over the pond and then twists it, and all of the stones fall down, and then they cause ripples to go out in every direction, to go forward, sideways, backwards. And of course, I realized that for Einstein, time did not go in a linear way, did not go forward, 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 but it was a whole space-time fabric. And so I was talking his language, I guess. And then I said, well, what happens, when there's a trauma in these wave fronts? And he said, well, yes, because if two wave fronts get stuck, then everything after that will be distorted. And I realized that's the way. And I asked him, I said, well, Professor Einstein, how would I work with that? And he said, I'm sorry, Peter. I don't have that answer, that information, that answer, but you do. And so for the next couple of years, I've really explored how these messages get transmitted through energetic unfoldings and how to work with them gradually. So that was one of the last encounters we had. Okay, so that's active imagination. And so again, maybe I'm overly iterating this, but I knew that this was not a real occurrence. But about 30 years ago, 30, 35 years ago, I was visiting my family in New York, your neighbor, the Bronx. And I'd been downtown going to museums and so forth. So at the end of the day, I was coming back, taking the D train to 205th Street, climbing up the hill, entering my parents' apartment. And they were sitting on a couch together, on a sofa together. But I happened to notice above them was a bookshelf. And one of the books that caught my eye was Einstein's General Theory of R Relativity. And then that immediately triggered my memory of my encounters with Einstein. So I told my mother about those encounters, about my active imagination. And she stood up straight and she said, no, Peter, that really happened. And I thought, what? And I said, what? And she said, when I was 8 months pregnant with you, it was 8 months and you were in utero, your father and I were canoeing on this lake in New Jersey. And a wind squall came up and twisted the canoe, and they couldn't get back, and they surely would have perished. They would have died. And obviously, I wouldn't be having a conversation with you because I wouldn't be alive. And so along that, at that time, when they were almost certainly to die, the small sailboat came alongside them and pulled them to safety, pulled them into the boat, particularly the young woman. It was a young woman and an old man, a very old man. And once my parents were inside and they gave them a towel to dry off, they introduced themselves as Albert Einstein and his stepdaughter. So I don't know if I can really express what I experienced when my mother told me that story. And she went on to say, yes, that really happened because you bonded with Einstein in that moment of life threat. And it's true. He's always been a guide for me in different times, in different ways. And I just want to honor my mother's intuition that she knew that. I mean, I had a lot of problems with her, as many of us do, with our mothers and fathers. And but one of the gifts I've got from her, from both of them, was a quest for knowledge, but also for an intuition and learning to trust my intuition. So active imagination, I mean, where does the line, the blurry line be between active imagination and something that actually happened and then became registered in active imagination? I've pondered that, believe me, I've pondered that many, many, many times. And what I come up with, that both are true, that active imagination is an unconscious process, and there was a reality about those encounters with Einstein that I had not had the foggiest intuition of what they were. Well, I did have an intuition, but I didn't know they were.
And so that is really something you say that that happens in kind of a borderline or twilight zone
Yes.
where the distinction between what is real in a conventional everyday sense and what is has a larger reality
Yes,
is kind
exactly.
of blurry.
It is, you know, and in my book, which is called An Autobiography of Trauma, A Healing Journey, I really try to find that lumen, that limen between reality and between something that goes beyond. It's a different reality. There's not only one reality. And again, I try to kind of address that among many other things in the book,
So
how to live between those realities.
I thought that was one of the things that was very moving because you handled it not, say, as a philosopher doing some kind of abstract discussion about the various natures of reality and how to be in there, but
Yeah.
in describing your journey and what you felt along the way in these specific instances of navigating
Yes.
ordinary reality and other larger reality.
Exactly. You know, reality, what a concept. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, for many, many, many years, for 50 years, basically, I didn't speak about that. Because somatic experiencing was starting to be taken into the mainstream, and I didn't want to do anything that might interfere with that, so I pushed that aside. I wouldn't tell this to anybody. But then, in writing the autobiography, and this in my later years, which is also a wonderful book by Einstein, his kind of his autobiography, I decided that I was going to tell my truth wherever it would lead, wherever it would lead. And I had persistence, and I think I had courage in following that dream. You know, there's a Isabel Allende,
Ayende.
Allende. I heard a talk she gave, a TED talk, and she mentions this quote. I think it's a Jewish, Hasidic, a Jewish quote. And the quote is, "What's truer than truth? Answer the story." And I believe, well, I told my story, and I believe we all have stories to tell, and that are equally as important to them as and to others who they might share it with. But I deeply believe that if we do our own self-examination and write about it, that will come at very least to a deeper understanding of who we are and how we are in the world.
And so what came up for me in reading the book was actually a different understanding of SE than I've had, in the sense of seeing the role of active imagination in the process.
Yeah.
And for instance, way back when in Waking the Tiger, just you were talking about this young Finnish guy. And when he or I forgot if he is
Danish guy, I think.
English. Okay, it's been a long time since I read it.
Actually, he's from Greenland,
Okay,
actually.
from Greenland.
If you're talking about the same person, yes.
Yes, and no, I believe so. And that the something about as he's finding the movement in his legs, something unfolds,
Yes.
and
Yes.
so at the time. My understanding of it was about all of the things about ethology, about how we're different from animals, that movements can be blocked instead of
Allow.
allowed. And so more of the physiological part of it. But
Yeah.
actually, in reading the book and in your latest book, I see how actually SE makes it possible for active imagination to unlock the movement.
Very well said. I may wind up quoting you on that with your permission.
You're more than welcome.
I think it's absolutely true because that is very much like active imagination. And the person is Marius, and
Yes.
he's a native of Greenland, a wonderful young man. And when you're talking about his legs, this is something that was very important for me in my healing, dealing with a overwhelming threat and violence to reconnect to my legs. Maybe I say a little bit about kind of the context of the situation. It was nothing that my father was doing wrong, but because of some coincidences, he was being asked to testify against Johnny DiGuardo, Johnny Dio of the he was the mafia don of New York. He was like the Al Capone of New York. Really vicious man. I have a picture. I debated whether to put it in, but I do have a number of pictures. One picture of him, and you look at this man and you think, oh my God, this guy is pure evil. You know, there are two movies, The Goodfellas and The Irishman, and he's the person in both of those movies. If you want the most violent hits, that's the person you would get to do it because he was vicious. He was without any moral constraint at all. So my father was made to testify against him. And my father was told that if he did testify, he would find his family face down in the East River. In other words, we would all be murdered. So for many years, we were living with this horrible threat. And during that time, as a way to let my parents know how violent he could be, I was violently attacked and raped by some these thugs from the mafia. And in somatic experiencing, we don't take people back into their traumas and have them relive their traumas over and over again. That makes no sense. It can make things worse. But it's really finding a way to have new experiences in the body that contradict those of overwhelming helplessness and terror. And so I was experiencing some difficult sensations and feelings and occasional flashes of image. So I asked one of my students to sit with me and to guide me. And when we sat down, she was helping me follow my sensations. Chiron is the wounded healer. We all have to do our own healing if we're going to be healers, to heal ourselves, of course, but also to heal others. So that's really essential. And but her guidance took me back to a positive image that I could feel throughout my whole body, and that's the key, of when I was 4 or 5 years old, and it was my birthday. It must have been in the night or early in the morning. My parents came into my bedroom and they laid some tracks from a model train set underneath my bed, out into the room, back to the other side of the room, and then back underneath in an oval underneath the bed. And so when I awoke, I don't really even have the right words. I wouldn't say excited. I exhilarated is closer, but I was just beyond myself. I just jumped up and ran over to the transformer to control the speed and to make the horn beep. And though I didn't have the words for it at the time, this, of course, was a complete body experience. But it was the time that I felt that I was cared for, that I felt loved. And with almost all of us, there was that time when somebody cared about us and somebody loved us. And it's really important to be able to return to that because when you even depending how difficult and traumatic life you've had, if there is one experience of aliveness and being cared about and being loved, That will make all the difference in healing the wounds of trauma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The aliveness, the connection, the being
Yes.
cared for, and the body memory of it.
Yes, and that's the key, that it has to be embodied. You know, in Papua New Guinea, there's a saying that if it that knowledge doesn't exist unless it's in the body. And I say that was right. I think the quote is unless it's in the muscles, but it means in the body. And it's one of the great truths that I've pursued throughout my life, how to become more embodied. I mean, quite frankly, when I came out to Berkeley in 1964, I didn't know I had a body. But I had some formative experiences where I started to realize, yeah, I did have a body. And that body also was a lot of my trauma was registered in the body. And one of the chapters in the book is the four most important women in my life and the four most important men in my life. And I really talk about my encounter with these people and how much it meant to me and how much they helped me to begin to learn that I had a body and that the body was the on the shore of the ocean of being. And each of those four women in different ways have brought my awareness to the living, sensing, knowing body. And so I wanted to honor them as the giants whose shoulders that I stood upon or whose heart that I felt in my heart.
And so that feels very powerful because you did a lot of scientific research and understanding. And despite all of this understanding, when it came to that moment where you needed help, you asked a student of yours to be there because you could not, despite all of that knowledge,
That's right.
figure it out without the connection.
Exactly. Exactly. I talk about that quite a bit in one of my other books, In an Unspoken Voice. I was hit by a car and I literally was out of my body, or perceived myself from looking down from above my body. And all of the tools that I developed, I wasn't able to use until this woman who introduced herself as a pediatrician. And I remember thinking, that's exactly the specialty I need right now. And she asked if what she could do. And I said, please just stay here with me. And she sat down, so she wasn't above me looking down, but at the same level, and took my hand in her hand. And in that moment, it's like I came back into my body and I could process through that trauma in ways that I knew, but that I was unable to do it without that connection. You know, there's a great Motown song that goes something like, it takes one to stand in the dark alone. It takes two to let the light shine through. Another thing in that same book, Unspoken Voice, I say that trauma isn't so much, it's not even just what happens to us, but it's what I mean, it is in some ways, but what it is more is what we hold inside in the absence of that present empathetic other, as that woman was for me, and as my guide in processing it with SC was for me. So those are really, really essential to have those ingredients together. And then the right tools, because with the right tools, trauma does not rule. But without tools, trauma rules. So how to bring together connection and the techniques, I guess you could say.
And so that's that blend. And so you honor the connection, the need for it, and in a way, it's an exemplar of how we can't do it alone. And you describe your journey of how the gratitude of having the help of getting into your body, and the that's getting into the body is not a mechanical thing, but is something that's really related to the connection you have with these women and they have for you. And so there is that quality of connection there as well in the learning to be embodied as a medial experience from having had in childhood.
I always wonder, how is it that I was attracted to them? They were attracted to me. They took me underneath their wings. I pondered that a lot. And the nearest thing I came to was there was some kind of a karma there. In Cat's Cradle, a novel by Kurt Vonnegut, there's a religion called Bakkanan. And people recognize each other by touching their feet together, soul to soul, you might say. And I think I was, and they call that group a karass, KARASS. And I think we were in the same karass with these wonderful people. And not only those as teachers, but in my whole life and coming into my feeling body, my emotional body, my sensual body, my sexual body, I thank so many of the women who have taken me kindly into their hearts and connecting with their bodies, that I'm internally grateful for them. It's been a real important part of my growth. And in SE, it's not that you do everything at once, because like you said, it's a progress, it's a work in progress. And so, and I try again in the book, I follow my progression as meeting with these different people and being together intimately and learning. One of the reviewers of the book wrote, "This man's journey from searing pain to joy, from self-hatred to self-love." And I think that's really been the trajectory of my book, of my life and book.
And so it's in a way it's a description. You write something that's very personal and has a lot of detail, and at the same time it's a book about the human condition.
Yes,
You happen to
the
be
spirit,
a
the human.
human and describing that experience, and you're not outside of the human condition.
No, not at all. That's a good way to put it, Serge. It's part of our deeply shared humanity we operate from, that we have the choice to operate from.
And so to come back to that notion of active imagination, it felt like, that what I had, one of my first takes about SE was about how we were deprived of the possibility that animals had to discharge their energy in the process of dealing with threat
That's
because
right.
of the constraints of living in society. And in paying attention to active imagination, I think what you're describing is a journey in which you can actually use that to have a virtual reality of doing what our remote ancestors were doing in the state of nature.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
And so you
In congruence with nature's laws.
But
We
finding
are.
something that is adapted to who we are, because we're not just
We're not just
bodies.
animals, but we are animals for sure, but very special animals. But also, one of the things that animals do well, which we do not do well, is when animals are threatened, which a prey animal, that may happen many times in a day, many, many times in a day. They don't carry this. I'm talking about wild animals in their natural environment. They rarely carry that trauma with them. Because they innately know how to discharge that energy, that shock energy, in gentle shaking and vibrating and deep, easy, full breaths, spontaneous breaths. But the very things that bring them back to equilibrium, we fear them and we stop them. We resist them. And then we don't get to go through the whole experience because we're stuck. Again, animals don't do that, near as I can understand. But we do. And in somatic experiencing, SE, what we're doing is helping people learn where they became stuck and how to become unstuck, how to let those restorative sensations and feelings move through in their body and come to equilibrium and and homeostasis.
But so what animals do physically through SE, we do in the virtual reality
Yes.
of the therapeutic relationship.
That's right. That's right.
And so you talk also about shamanic healing. And it struck me of how maybe what the shamans did in healing was something that, with the technology of their time and the ideology of their time, creating something which you then did with the scientific knowledge and technology that, of the 21st century.
To hold together science and shamanism, that this was a, that's the right word for it. I don't want to say primitive, because in a way it's quite refined,
Archetypal.
archetypal. I think archetypal is the best word for it. And and some people have said, well, I'm a shaman, and because I want people to understand, it's not a special gift that I have, but it's something that's learnable, that's transmissible, and that people can learn to do. But I've also been blessed by having contact in different parts of the world with shamans and really learning how they see trauma. Some shamans use the term, or do the term describe what they do is sustu. And sustu literally means, it's in Portuguese and in Spanish, means fright paralysis. So how to he help people heal who are stuck in the fright, and how they know how to get where they're stuck and to help move them forward. And I've learned a lot from shamans around the world. And one of the things I've learned is that in real intact societies, they don't just, it's not an individual. It's not patient, client, therapist, doctor. It's something that we have lost because we've lost community. And in these archetypical societies, people heal together. They mourn together. They dance and joy together. I had the privilege of visiting the Krenaki people. It's an indigenous tribe pretty far in the remote areas of Brazil. And the chief there really showed me how important it was to heal in community, to heal in within the tribe. Very, very important. And also, a long time ago, I came across the work of an anthropologist named, anyhow, he studied the Matumbo people, the pygmy, the forest pygmies in Africa, Turnbull, Colin Turnbull. And if somebody lost somebody that they loved, or lost somebody to ill this, or they were ill, the group would meet together, and all night they would wail and cry and shake and tremble together. But then in the morning light, they would go into the jungle, deep into the jungle, and they would dance ecstatically. So it was transforming that pain. And we don't have those kind of rituals. We're attempting, I think, to try to find some relevant kind of rituals that we can embody, but we have so much to learn from them.
And so maybe that is kind of a note that is both somewhat mournful but also hopeful of next frontier. For us to become more aware of how much of trauma is not just an individual illness, but is a reflection of the society we live in.
And my very dear friend, Gabor Mate wrote a really good book called, help me with it, The Myth of Normal. That our society is normal, but it's anything but normal. It's an outlier. It's a, yeah.
And so maybe that's a good way to kind of put a bookmark to this as an end to our conversation, because in some way, what your book does, the autobiography of trauma, is puncture the myth of normal.
Yes, in a way, yeah. In other words, Gabor and I are both speaking about different aspects of what should be normal. Yeah, no, that's good. That's good. I'm sure he'll appreciate that. I'll pass it on.
So I want to thank you for this
Sure.
conversation.
If it's okay, if I mention that the book, of course, can get wherever books are sold, and also. They can get information on other material and other books from the website somaticexperiencing.com, which also links to to traumahealing.org. So if you want to find a therapist in your area, because we have trainees in 44 countries now, you can get that information and also see where there are trainings. And I really suggest anybody who does any kind of healing work, they should at least take the first modules of that training to really embody those skills of connecting with the sensing, living, knowing body. So, with that, it was good talking with you, Serge.
Thank you very much, Peter.
And I guess we sign off here.
Yes. This is part of the Active Pause podcast. To see more and subscribe to the newsletter, go to activepause.com.